Yesterday, I had a show-and-tell session in which I explained to you objects that illustrate for us daily life in the lands of the Bible, the way in which the people lived, built their houses, and the way in which they carried on trade and commerce. By way of summary, I would like to read two passages from the scriptures to you that I hope will bring back some of what you saw yesterday. The one passage is a section of Psalm 104. I am reading verses 13 through 23 according to the translation of the New English Bible. It deals with the human being's place in God's creation. A prayer that in this section deals with the human being's place in God's creation. It is a prayer addressed to God. From thy high pavilion thou dost water the hills. The earth is enriched by thy provision. Thou makest grass grow for the cattle and green things for those who toil for men, bringing bread out of the earth and wine to gladden men's hearts, oil to make their faces shine, and bread to sustain their strength. The trees of the Lord are green and leafy, the cedars of Lebanon, which he planted. The birds build their nests in them, the stork makes her home in their tops. High hills are the haunt of the mountain goat, and boulders a refuge for the rock badger. Thou hast made the moon to measure the year, and taught the sun where to set. When thou makest darkness and it is night, all the beasts of the forest come forth, the young lions roar for prey, seeking their food from God. When thou makest the sun rise, they slink away and go to rest in their lairs, but man comes out to his work and to his labors until evening. And a shorter passage from the book Jesus Ben Sira, one of the intertestamental wisdom writings. The passage is found in the 39th chapter, the 26th verse, where you find a short list of the basic necessities for human life. The chief necessities of human life are water, fire, iron and salt, flour, honey and milk, the juice of the grape, oil and clothing. Today I would like to complete the series on the adventure of biblical archaeology, show and tell sessions. On Monday I showed you the collection of lamps, the earliest one from the Middle Bronze Age, the time of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, and the youngest of the lamps bought in 1959 from a Christian Arab potter in Jerusalem. Yesterday I showed you objects, as I already indicated, highlighting daily life, architecture, and trade and commerce. What remains to be done today is to show you some objects that illustrate for us warfare in the lands of the Bible, and in a way I'm very sorry that this has to be part of the presentation. And then lastly, some objects that highlight religion in the lands of the Bible. Now before I go to this, let me say this in relation to the second topic, religion in the lands of the Bible. You know that one of the most characteristic features of the religion of ancient Israel, of the Hebrew Scriptures, of the Old Testament, is that the religion of the God of Israel is, as we say, uniconic. That is a technical term which means the God of Israel cannot be represented by any tangible image or item. Thou shalt make no graven images. Now, if this is so, then it means that we will have very few remains, tangible remains, of the religion of ancient Israel, precisely because it was uniconic. It did not move into the representation of the divine through an image or an idol. This is on the whole borne out by what archaeologists have found in the lands of the Bible. we have really not found any direct religious remain of the religion of ancient Israel for that very reason. You will see this when I bring out the objects that I can show you, because they relate much more to the religion of the other nations, of the Canaanites who lived in Palestine at the time. But it also brings to mind the observation of one of my teachers who said, where in other religions there stood the idol, the image representing the divine, at that place there stood in ancient Israel the word of the Lord. Where in other religions there stands the tangible image, representation of the divine, in that place, as far as ancient Israel is concerned, in that place stands the word of the Lord. And I think that this is a very important observation in this connection. But now let me proceed. I have again laid out my table with the black cloth of the magician. The first item I would like to show you, I'm sure you will be able to identify rather readily, it deals with, quote, warfare in ancient Israel. Have you any idea what this might be? Right, a sling stone. This is a sling stone. Now, sling stones are archaeologically useless. Why? Because they never change. The little Arab boys use the same sling stones today as presumably David used many centuries ago. We are quite sure that this was a sling stone because it was found in Shechem in the late bronze layers, and it did not get there naturally or by itself. If you found it in a riverbed, of course, there it gets by itself. In fact, that's where it is produced. So we note that we find them and duly record it, but then whoever would like to take it home or has a nephew who might be interested in it, it is his or hers for the taking. And this is what I have here, a sling stone. The next item also is an original, and it is probably harder for you to see. I'm trying to hold it up into the light, but maybe some of you can make it out. Right, this is an arrowhead. It is very similar to the other chert that I showed to you yesterday, which probably was a kitchen knife, but here it is very clear that it was an arrowhead. It is very regularly shaped. It was tied to a shaft, of course, and then used in warfare. The next item that relates to warfare in the lands of the Bible is this, and it is a replica. Can you identify this?
Spearhead.
Right, this is a spearhead. I have seen a spearhead come out of a tomb which accidentally was discovered by a bulldozer clearing land leveling off land for a new shed for one of the kibbutzim in Galilee. The find was brought to the local archaeological sub-inspector, an Orthodox rabbi not practicing, who very well knows archaeology, and who was very excited and called us in. We happened to be in Meron at the time. And here I saw a spearhead very much like this, as well preserved as this one. Now you see, the preservation of metal depends on the acidity of the soil. The more acid you have, the more metal will corrode. In Upper Galilee, in most places, the acidity of the soil is rather low, and therefore coins and other metal remains are rather well preserved. The description given by the publisher of this is like this: bronze spearhead. This spearhead was part of the funerary offerings in a cist grave. Now, most of these words call for further comments. The ancients buried their dead with gifts. And that goes back to a very ancient belief that in a life to come, or whatever life they enter, they should at least be supplied with enough means to move comfortably into it. So food is given to the dead, but also their weapons, or the implements with which they made their living. Hence we find the best pieces, bowls, pitchers, cups,
lamps, or metal objects like this in tombs. Tombs are usually not dug. For one thing, it is very hard to find them. The Bedouins and some of the indigenous people have just the right nose to find the tombs and will then empty them, and in this way many objects will either get into museums or, more often than not, into the hands of antiquities dealers. And there's much of a gray and black market in that respect, but they're the most beautiful pieces. At any rate, this is why in tombs, beautiful objects whole are found. The archaeologist usually finds them broken. By the way, cook pots are very rare for a very simple reason. Cook pots were not put into graves, into tombs. So to get a whole cook pot, any museum is very happy with that. Plates, that you get quite a few. The narrow, elongated weapon, which was probably carried on a long wooden shaft, was used for thrusting. The spearhead has a raised midrib and is decorated with incisions. When you later inspect it, you can see this. The spear is one of the attributes of Reshef, that is one of the gods of ancient Canaan, more exactly the storm god, and of Anat, a female goddess, two deities in the Canaanite Phoenician pantheon. Pantheon is a technical term that refers to the totality of all the gods in a certain society, all the gods that are worshipped there. I should mention that when I left Israel in August 1976, I, as all other people leaving Israel, was thoroughly searched. These security measures at Lod Airport. The young woman who did the search, and it took half an hour, by the way, one person half an hour, asked me, "Do you have any weapons?" Oh, I said, "No, I don't have any weapons." "Well, let me open your suitcase." "Fine." The first thing she pulled out was this. And she said, "You said you had no weapons?" I had to plead guilty. She was very interested. She had taken archaeology in college, in university, and the search took so long because she wanted to have a little comment on most of these items. Another item of ancient warfare is this. You make that out. This is a battle axe. Yes, this is a battle axe. Again, here was a handle, fairly long. And this was used to cleave helmets or skulls. No. Oh, no. Separate ones. This comes from the Middle Canaanite, Middle Bronze period, 2200 to 1500 BCE. It was found near Jerusalem, and it is described here as a bronze battle axe. The narrow, elongated axe served for cleaving war helmets. It was probably mounted on a wooden shaft which was inserted into the socket. The slight irregularity in the socket facilitated the attachment of the blade to the shaft. Such battle axes are one of the commonest weapons of the time and are found in many of the tombs of that period. This concludes the showing of objects related to warfare in ancient Israel. Of course, at this point, I'm sorely tempted to read the beautiful passage which is found both in the book of Isaiah in chapter 2 and in the book of Micah in chapter 4. And let me succumb to this temptation. Let me use the Isaianic version. In days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be set over all other mountains, lifted high above the hills. All the nations shall come streaming to it, and many peoples shall come and say, "Come, let us climb up onto the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and we may walk in his paths." For instruction issues from Zion, and out of Jerusalem comes the word of the Lord. He will be judge between nations, arbiter among many peoples. They shall beat their swords into mattocks, and their spears into pruning knives. Nation shall not lift sword against nation, nor ever again be trained for war. So So much for a biblical comment on these four items. The next section, and the last section, is remains of the religion in the lands of the Bible. And here you need to recall what I said earlier about the uniconic character of the religion of Israel. The first item I would like to show you, you will probably be able to identify very quickly. It is tiny. It even comes with a little pedestal. This is a little calf, if you wish, a little golden calf. It was made from bronze. The metal is not of the greatest importance in this connection. This is a bull image. Now, of course, you know from the Bible how sensitive the Israelites were in the matter of, quote, quote, the golden calf or the golden bull. Why is this so? This is so because the bull was an animal sacred to the Canaanite god Baal. In other words, it was a symbol of another religion. Not just another religion, but a religion that was the prime competitor, that was the threat to the religion of ancient Israel. Now you will understand why many Old Testament writers condemn so strongly the golden calf. It is a strange, a foreign religious symbol. Now what you have here is such a little representation. Let me read to you what the publisher has to say. It comes from the late Canaanite bronze period, the 13th century BCE, roughly the time of Moses and Joshua. A bull made of wrought bronze. The four legs must have been stuck in a base of some sort. He has supplied this little wooden base. Found in the burnt ruins of the Holy of Holies of the Canaanite temple in Area H at Hazor. Hazor was a very important city in the upper Jordan Valley, of which we read in Joshua chapter 11, together with many ritual objects. It is unknown whether and how this representation of a bull is to be connected to Canaanite religion and mythology. Now here a true scholar speaks. He is very careful making any definite assertion. Therefore he says it is not certain. It may have been a votive gift of a worshipper. Now a votive gift is some object which a worshipper sets up in a shrine or sanctuary to represent him or her praying, adoring the deity. So, for instance, in many churches, Christian churches, you have the custom of setting up a burning candle in the church. The burning candle is a votive gift. It represents you there, even after you have left. This is a very common practice. I have been almost 6 years in India, and I have observed it many times in Hindu temples. That is a votive gift. And that is what is possibly the use of this one. It is a nice example of art and technical skills of late Bronze Age Canaan. Again, I invite you to come and inspect it later. The next item is of a somewhat different kind, but also very descriptive of a certain aspect of the religion of ancient Canaan. See this. Now, something is broken away here. The legs or the feet are broken away. This is a nude female figure. It is a Canaanite fertility figurine. It is a little Ashtarte figure of which we read in the Old Testament. Now, what is behind that story? Something very simple. One of the most basic concerns for human life, individually and corporately, is the continuation of life, the securing of life. For the ancients, life was much more precarious than it is for us. For instance, infant mortality, you know, is very low today. In ancient times, it was very high. Hence, you will understand why for the ancients, the maintenance of life, the ensuring of fertility, was one of the most basic human concerns. And small wonder that it is primarily spelt out in religious terms. So you usually have deities that come in male-female pairs in order to symbolize the ideal setting for the procreation and the continuation of life. I could mention many more aspects of fertility religion understood in this way. Here you have, if you wish, a Canaanite version of it. In fact, these fertility figurines served as little fertility charms. Probably they were carried or about, or more likely set up in houses, very much like we set up, or some people set up, a talisman. Quite a few of these have been found. They are very characteristic of a Canaanite religion. I recall one of the first finds I made 10 years ago in Shechem, when my first job was to clear the dump which the German excavators, Professor Selin of Berlin, had left half a century earlier. I found one of these, bottom half only. Of course, it was duly recorded, and we wondered why the Germans had not kept this. After all, that's important. Oh, well, we joke. A German reject is only the bottom half.
It looks so Egyptian.
It's highly stylized. Yes, I would think these forms are found all through the ancient Near East, and you have quite a bit of back and forth in the actual shape. Let me read to you what the editor here has to say. This figurine was made in a mold, and the back is slightly rounded. It represents a young and slender nude woman wearing a wig falling onto her shoulders and anklets on her feet. Her arms are extended along the sides. The tips of her feet are broken off. Such figurines probably served as fertility charms and are commonly found in private houses. This one was found in the Jordan Valley in the Beth Shan area, and it is dated to the late Bronze Age, roughly the time of Moses and Joshua. Now, of course, I could refer you to quite a few Old Testament passages where such fertility figurines are mentioned in one way or another. Genesis 35 comes to mind, maybe also the teraphim, of which we hear in the story of Rachel, that she took along from Mesopotamia and then hid in a camel's saddle, a rather humorous story that you can read for yourself in the 30th chapter of the book of Genesis. The next item, the second last I would like to show you, is one that has puzzled the excavators and the interpreters. Let's see what your guess is. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing comes to mind right away. It looks like an implement that we have today and use that sits on our desk. Right, a letter opener. That's indeed what it has been called right away, the letter opener. But then when you inspect it a little bit more closely, you see that at the top is a stylized head and then two stubs sticking out, maybe arms. Furthermore, of course, they didn't need a letter opener in a Canaanite shrine. They didn't have letters like we have them. And so scholars have wondered whether it is a votive figure, again, stuck up to represent the worshipper, or whether it was a ritual knife. You see, this is rather pointed and sharp, with which animals were slaughtered. You know that the ancients, that you know from the Old Testament, had to be very careful about draining all the blood. At any rate, that these are possibilities, let me read to you what it says here. Again, this comes from the late Canaanite period. It was found again at Hazor, which proved to be almost like a treasure trove for archaeologists. And he identifies it in this way. A bronze male deity with outstretched arms and conical helmet found at the Holy of Holies of the Canaanite temple at Hazor in Galilee. And I note he does not venture to make further suggestions as to what its probable use might have been. The last item I would like to show you also comes from Hazor. It is a replica on a reduced scale. This is what it looks like. I have seen the original, which stands approximately this high. This is reduced. You see that it is a stone slab, on which two outstretched arms, parallel to each other and pointing upward, are pictured. At the top is something that cannot be too quickly identified. Many have identified it as a symbol of the moon god, a winged disc. That may indeed be so. Now, the theory is that also this was a votive offering. In other words, that it was put up in the temple to represent the worshipper with both hands stretched out in a position of veneration and adoration, and that the symbol here represents the particular god of this particular shrine. This is, I think, what the publisher has to say here. Canaanite cult stele. Stele is a technical term for a worked stone slab that is set up for a purpose. The basalt stele was discovered in a small Canaanite shrine, which also contained a statue, a lion orthostat, and other stele. This stele bears a simple expressive design, hands stretched upward in a gesture of supplication towards an emblem of the deity composed of a disc within a crescent. The shrine may have been dedicated to the moon god. And then reference is made to the original publication. Now, friends, these replicas and the two originals really represent all that I have to show to you today. I think it is fitting that I conclude this series with this votive stone that shows two hands stretched out toward heaven in supplication. And I think it should remind us that the whole-scale condemnation of other religions, which we sometimes encounter in some of the starker prophetic voices of the Old Testament, needs to be balanced by the awareness that in the other religions, human beings stretched out their hands toward the divine. And I think this stands in its own right too. Or as the prophet Micah or one of his disciples said, Israel, let us walk in the light of the Lord. Let other people walk in the light of their religion. A spirit of tolerance speaks out of this passage in Micah 4. Now this concludes the series, The Adventure of Biblical Archaeology. What I have tried to do is to give you a feel, tangible feel, for the world in which the biblical writings took shape. If anything, it gives to me, who works with these things and also as an archaeologist, an added sense of solidarity with these ancient peoples. You see, there is the temptation, or if you wish, the danger, that these ancients who gave us the sacred writings become so far removed from us because we have contact with them only through the written page, the written word, that they almost become completely removed from us. Digging in Palestine, doing biblical archaeology, or then working with objects like this gives one a sense of solidarity. And more than once in my work with the biblical text itself has this sense of solidarity helped me to grasp more fully what is at stake there. In other words, they struggled like we do today. They stood in the same issues and tensions and debates as we do. And more often than not, I recognize this solidarity then also in their writings. Now, that is all. The time is almost up. Maybe you have some questions you would like to ask.
Did you say the two originals are the calf and the...
No,
these two. Over there.
Oh, these would be very carefully guarded in a museum. I have seen the originals of most of these. They are very well done replicas. I have been in the little factory which this person has in one of the western suburbs of Jerusalem, where he gets the originals for a number of days, and with the permission of the Department of Antiquities produces these, which then in turn are sold at the Israeli museums and are widely used in Israeli schools and institutions of learning to illustrate. In fact, he has a whole collection that you can buy.
this isn't to do with the things you have there, but could you explain some of your feelings about the idea of harem in the Wars of Conquest?
Oh, yes.
Too broad of a...
All right, then we have to... Let me do it as quickly as I can. I will repeat it for you. In various passages in the Old Testament, we read descriptions of war. And here the Israelites are pictured as completing the war, finishing their campaigns by completely killing off men, women, and children, animals, and then burning the cities. That you find several times, for instance, in the first half of the book of Joshua. Our questioner has used the Hebrew technical term, the harem, which means this complete banning, B-A-N-N-I-N-G, of all that has been found. Now, this is a fairly difficult question because it relates to an institution that we know from ancient Israel, but also from its neighbors, called the Holy War. There's a lot of debate on this score. My own interpretation of the Holy War is that only when a religious community has been attacked and is threatened, will it in turn respond with a holy war and will then completely obliterate the threat. Now that, I think, is the theory. In other words, it's a defensive measure, but then a total defensive measure. I personally think that all this is primarily a literary creation of certain theologians of the Old Testament who carried out total verbal warfare that way. And the book of Deuteronomy is a fairly good example. In other words, I think I would say that none of these total obliterations were literally carried out, but that these were ways in which the ancient Israelites verbally got rid of the enemy. And the enemy were the Canaanites, the threat to their religion. So it's a little bit like hell and fire and brimstone preaching, you see. Verbal warfare. Better that than actual warfare. That was a very deceptive question. Other questions?
Are all of these actual signs except for the one on the left?
Yes, all of these are actual signs. Yes, please.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you finance
the expedition? That's a sore spoiler point. But I'm most glad to do this. Who knows? We might get some financing. Actually, expeditions, archaeological expeditions, have to be licensed by the host government. And the host government nowadays is very careful licensing expeditions. In most host countries, say Israel, Syria, Iran, Iraq, Egypt, the expedition has to be sponsored or co-sponsored by an institution in that country itself, the University of Cairo, University of Jerusalem, or what have you. Then they may co-opt institutions in Europe or North America or Japan even. Then comes the next point of getting the money together. Some institutions, for instance, the seminary where I serve, and Duke University with which we are connected, have set aside in their budget a certain amount, a limited amount. It is for every year at the seminary where I serve, $5,000. That's what we can contribute. So you see, that's a shoestring budget. Now, Duke contributes somewhat more. They're a bigger place, and they have, I think, some good stock somewhere. At any rate, when we then have enough money together, we think that we can make an application, say, to the Smithsonian, or the National Fund for the Endowment of the Humanities, I think I've quoted correctly, and they will then sometimes give us matching funds. Say, we have raised $25,000, they will give us another $25,000. And then we can go into the field with 50,000 every second year. The labor is volunteer. In many cases, students, undergraduates or graduates. Last summer, I taught 4 Duke undergraduates who did this for summer credit, both the digging and the supervising and the recording. So they have to pay their own fare. They do not have to pay room and board at the dig, but they do have to pay tuition. We who are the supervisors are usually on the faculties of seminaries or universities or museums. And we do this more for continuing education, you see. So I do not get anything extra. In fact, I lose any extra income I might have through summer teaching. Never mind. But that is roughly the way in which we finance it. Usually on a shoestring budget, and we are very careful to limit what we excavate very carefully. 5 meters by 5 meters. Probe trench, 2 meters by 2 meters. That's it. Does that answer your question?
Then anything that you find in that area you can keep, or do you have to...
Oh, no. Anything that is found belongs to the host government. But this is the agreement that is usually enforced. 1 or 2 years after each campaign, a division of finds is made. The Department of Antiquities of the host government will sit down with the director of the expedition and will claim for the host government all pieces that they want. Now, normally it works out this way, that they will take of each item a representative, the best sample. Let's say we find 5 fertility figurines, 2 badly beaten up, 1 in excellent condition, and 2 so-so. They will keep the best one, okay? Then the 4 that are left, we may take our pick, and then the rest is divided. That's roughly how it runs. But the understanding is that whatever you get, host government or sponsoring institution, has to be published responsibly as soon as possible, so that it is available to the scholarly community, and that it is always available for scholarly study. For instance, I can go to the Department of Antiquities in Jerusalem, and since I'm qualified, can say, I would like to see the pottery from this excavation from that stratum. And then I will find it in their ledger, and they have to produce it for me, complete with a big table to study it and a decent room to do it. That's the way it works.
Thank you.
Well, friends, it is 9:15. This is the end of this series, The Adventure of Biblical Archaeology. I appreciate your attention. Thank you very much.